It's a pleasure to be with you tonight at Mount Pleasant. And, of course, I was with you last year, and yet I got invited back. I was texting back and forth with my good friend Dale Byram that I understand y'all support. He and I were missionaries together in New Zealand a number of years ago, and he was, I was telling him that, you know, they had invited me back this year, and he said, well, I guess they're going to give you a chance to make up for it for what happened last year. So maybe that's the case. I bring you greetings from your brethren over in Logan County, Crittenden Drive congregation. And we've been there, in fact, just starting our third year, finished second year just actually this week. So it's great to be back over here. And I'm so excited about your history. And, of course, I love history, and I've been kind of dedicated to it. And I think that's one of the things, reasons Larry's down here. He is encouraging me, but yet we have a mutual love and appreciation for restoration history. And when Tom and I were talking about the kind of class I'd like to do or kind of lesson I'd like to do, I thought it might be good for us to do about 6,000 or 8,000 years of history. Would you like to do that for about 30 minutes? We're going to have to move fast, and we're going to have to say a lot of things quickly, and forgive me if I don't really give you a good introduction to everything I've got to show you, but I really want to put us in the picture of the overall history of God, and it might be that you've never kind of seen it from this standpoint. I love your timeline. Tom showed that to me and Larry a few moments ago, and I love your history. A congregation nearly 200 years old just has to, you have such wonderful heritage, and that's something you really ought to be excited about. You young people, it's so hard for you to think about history because you hadn't lived long in it. Love the story of your church family. Love the story of the past because you have a wonderful heritage and a wonderful story. And so I guess let's enter into it. I guess we want to call this lesson God's Family Through the Ages. I do have my website up there and invite you to look at that website. I've chronicled over 1,000 gospel preachers and probably have about 6,000 or 8,000 listed on the website, and you can go there and read about people in history on that site. So do pull it up and have a look at it on the web. But as you can see, the pictures there, we're just kind of looking down through a picture of down through time, really. You go back to the very beginning, and you can see that, you know, sin came into the world when Adam and Eve ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and with that, God made a promise. He told the serpent, I'll put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, you'll bruise his heel. Genesis 3 and verse 15. And so there you see the beginning of a plan that God has to redeem man, bring man back to a relationship with him through Jesus Christ. As you go down through history, we reach Daniel chapter 2, children of Israel are in Babylonian captivity, and Daniel interprets this great dream that Nebuchadnezzar has. And you remember it's the giant, and he tells him that the head of gold that he saw was his nation, talking about the Babylonian Empire, talked about the chest and the arms of silver being the Medo-Persian Empire, and he brings those things out even later on in his book. Middle of, and thighs of bronze, we can see is the Greek Empire, Alexander the Great and so on. The legs of iron with feet of partly iron, partly clay, the Roman Empire. And it was when he was interpreting this dream, in verse 44, he said, in the days of these kings, talking about during the period of the time of the Roman Empire, he said, the God of heaven will raise up a kingdom that'll never be destroyed. And this is when you have this introduction to this plan, or reintroduction of the plan that God has, a reminder that he's in control, he has a plan for man, and he's going to bring it about. Well, you reach into the New Testament, the birth of Christ, he grows up, he begins his ministry, and he starts talking about the fact that Matthew 4:17, he talks about repentance and that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And beginning with that and other passages, he starts talking about that kingdom and the nature of that kingdom. And he talks about how the nature of that kingdom was spiritual. And you see that as you watch the story unfold in the events that take place. Mark chapter 9 verse 1, he said, some of you standing here will not taste of death before you see the kingdom come with power. And then in Matthew 16, he explains to his disciples, based on the confession of Peter, on this rock I'll build my church, he says, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. In the very next verse, he says, and I'll give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. So that's really the first time you see in the same context God talking about the church and the kingdom and connecting the two in a powerful way. Well, when you get to Acts chapter 2, you got the disciples. Jesus has died on the cross, been buried, resurrected, and has ascended to heaven. And now on the day of Pentecost in Acts 2, you've got the apostles standing before thousands of people and proclaiming the message of the gospel for the first time. So he gets up, he talks about Joel's prophecy from Joel chapter 2, talking about old men dreaming dreams and things such as that. Part of that message was that whoever will call on the name of the Lord will be saved. That was something that God had promised when the Spirit was poured out on all flesh. And he says, that's happened right now. He refers to David's prophecies that he won't leave my soul in death. And he connects that with Jesus and how that Jesus was resurrected from the dead. So in verses 38 to 40, we see the church actually being established, the first 3,000 people obeying the gospel, and the Lord adding to the church daily those being saved. And so kingdom rule begins. Acts 2 and verse 42, they continued steadfastly in the apostles' teaching and the breaking of bread and fellowship and prayers. They were doing whatever the apostles said. And of course, the apostles were receiving it by revelation of Jesus Christ. Galatians 1:12, Paul says that. And so kingdom rule is taking place. The apostles are guiding them. The New Testament is in the process of being completed. And the church is growing. Well, you get people together and you're going to have problems. Part of the writings in the New Testament are dealing with problems that had taken place in some of the congregations. 1st and 2nd Corinthians. Boy, you're talking about a church that had problems. Corinth was just jam-packed full of them. And Paul had to deal with so many problems when he wrote his letters, the New Testament. Disunity through partyism, taking brothers to law, incest, denial even of the resurrection in chapter 15. The church at Colossae had problems with mysticism and Gnosticism. Boy, we could spend hours. Tom, you're going to preach on that next Sunday, if you will. Gnosticism, explain all that. But Revelation, the church, seven churches, all of them had issues to be either warned about or had concerns that he wanted to share with them. And of course, Paul said in his final meeting with the Ephesian brethren there at Miletus in Acts chapter 20 and verse 28, he warned them about the fact that after his departing, grievous wolves went entering in, not sparing the flock, and even from among yourselves. And so he encouraged them to beware and to watch and to heed to the things that God had already revealed in the gospel. And so in verse 32, he says, one of the final things he said is, I commend you to God in the word of his grace, which is able to build you up and give you an inheritance among all those who are sanctified. So they had a full vision and understanding that God had in mind that people would follow the New Testament and they would follow the things that the apostles had written down, and that would be their guide for spiritual living from here on out, at least until the Lord came again. And so that was the encouragement. However, you get to the end of the first century and you start seeing changes take place, and they start taking place rapidly. The death of the apostles take place. People get together, and I can't help, when I go back to read this history, that first 1,000 years, I can't help but think that a lot of what took place came from a sense of wanting to do what they felt like was the best thing to do. But the problem was, they didn't go back to the Bible and see if the things they were doing were exactly what God wanted them to do. And so when you get away from the Bible and you get your minds together and you start thinking about things, all of a sudden you start developing something that's far different from the church that you read about in the New Testament. So that's what was taking place in that 1,000 years after the first century. You have this development of a hierarchical system that's patterned very much like the Roman system, whereas you have spiritual leaders all the way to the top. And by the time you get to 606 AD, you've got an actual pontiff that's almost like like a Roman emperor who's sitting on the spiritual throne of God in Rome. Well, when that happened, there were people that didn't agree with this organization and with this process. There were, in fact, the more we research and the more we study, we're coming to find out all the way down through the years, there were groups of people, pockets of people that resisted going along with the organization that was separate from the Bible. And it's quite an interesting study to look at that. So you have departures that take place, and it was all because they left the Bible behind and didn't follow the things of the Scriptures. Of course, we know that led into the years that they call the Dark Ages. And around 1454, probably one of the greatest, if not the greatest invention that ever took place, was the Gutenberg Press. And in Mainz, Germany, the first thing that was ever produced on it was the Bible. Just the idea of being able to take and make, reproduce a copy of the Bible and make it affordable for people. Up until that time, every Bible had to be handwritten. And so if you wanted a copy of the Bible, it would usually take a year at least for several men who were had devoted their entire lives to doing this work to produce one volume. We can imagine how much that would have cost. And only the most wealthy would have a copy. But if you could get a printing press and be able to mass produce the thing, well, what does that usually do to the price of things? I guess one of the best ways to describe it is, you know, when you bought your first PC, your first computer, $2,000 or $3,000, now you can get them for $300 or $400. It's just cause the world's just flooded by it. Well, it's the same thing that happened with the Bible. And so with it though, once people, the local man, the farmer, was able to get his copy of the Bible and he started reading this book, one of the first things he began to notice is, well, you know, some of the things in this book we're not doing in the church I'm a part of. And they started even asking questions. Where do you find in this book what God says about the word pope? I can't even find the word pope in here. And so with it, you start having problems that arise. And so you've got several men through the years. We could spend, I've had whole semesters focused on this one screen. And so you've got men like John Wycliffe in England, John Huss in the Czech state. You've got Martin Luther in Germany, and you've probably heard of some of these other ones that were spread throughout Europe, starting out in the Roman church, but as they had the ability to study the ancient texts, they came to realize that many of the things that were being done in the established church were things that they couldn't find in the Bible, and so they started saying, you know, we need to straighten out our problem. We need to reform ourselves. We need to go back to the original and be what it was. Well, I guess it's kind of like if you've ever seen an old wrecked car that's just all rusty and worn out and to the point that it just can't be fixed. Well, that's kind of what had happened to this church. And so it had gotten to the point that they really need to kind of leave the structure behind and try to go back to the original structure that they found in the Bible. And so that's what we have when we see reformers. Just very briefly, John Calvin was from France, but lived in Switzerland. One of his students was John Knox, who was from Scotland, and Scotland was a hotbed of religious reform. Knox was fighting, and when I'm talking about fighting, he had an army. I mean, back then, all religions had armies. And so when they were talking about religious differences, they were also talking about national differences. And so they would rise up and not only dispute and debate with one another, but many of them had armies behind them, and they fought against even nations. And that's what happened with John Knox. He had the ability to fight. So if you go to Scotland, if you've ever been to Scotland, you go to St. Andrews and some of the other places, especially St. Andrews, it's kind of the home of Roman Catholicism in Scotland and in the 1540s, 1530s, 40s. Cardinal Beaton is the ruler, is the spiritual guide of the church. And he starts taking some of these young men who are going to St. Andrew's College, and they're talking about reform, and they're talking about going back to the Bible. People like John Wishart, and others, and Cardinal Beaton had a way to deal with them. He just kind of followed the guide of what was going on down in Rome, and sometimes he would take these men and he would burn them at stake. That's one way to quieten them down, and that's what they did with George Wishart. You can actually go and stand, you can see the little emblem in the road there. It's still there, where you can stand exactly the place where George Wishart, as a reformer, was burned to death, right outside Cardinal Beaton's castle. But John Knox led an army to come in and overthrow Cardinal Beaton, and they ended up burning him at the stake, the reformers. And through John Knox, you have the development of what is later known as the Church of Scotland, or today Presbyterianism. And of course, the influence of Calvin. If you think about Calvin, you think about Calvinism, the tulip doctrine. And so that was kind of the basic formula of their teaching and of their philosophy. And it spread through the way that they interpret the entire Bible. And so Knox, being one of the followers of Calvin, entered that as kind of the basis of how the Church of Scotland took place, and kind of the basics of their doctrine. So if you ever hear of the Westminster Confession of Faith and that is their basic covenant. It's their basic doctrine, and it's built on the foundation of Calvinism and all Presbyterianism even to this day, except for Cumberland Presbyterianism, which came along later on, followed this way of thinking. So, but in Scotland, in time, even there was an effort to withdraw. You have John Glass and his son-in-law, Robert Sandeman, who started a congregational, concept. The organization of the Church of Scotland was very much like the Roman Church. They had a one-head leadership in Edinburgh, and everything kind of flowed down from it. Well, John Glass was a Presbyterian minister, and the more he read his Bible, the more he came to realize that churches were actually self-run or self-controlled. They were autonomous, and so he started teaching, well, we need to do Bible things in Bible ways. We need to be self-controlled and not have one church over another and one hierarchical structure that ruled all of the people, and people loved the idea. It wasn't without problems. Robert Sandeman. What we are thankful to Robert Sandeman for is that not only did he buy into the idea of the congregational theme, but he also saw the fallacies of Calvinism. And he wrote a book called Letters on Theron and Aspasio. And I won't explain all of what all that means, but essentially what that book was is it was showing all the fallacies of Calvinism, point by point. Well, it was a book that just set Europe on fire. People were looking at it and they were saying, you mean Calvinism is not the way that we need to be seeing this, or we can't find this in the Bible, and was disproving once saved, always saved, or the idea that, you know, that God mysteriously overwhelms somebody with some sort of experiencing, showing them that they are irresistibly called by him, and that Sandeman was showing that the scriptures don't teach that. People would actually, if they wanted to be a follower of God, they could just decide to become a follower of God. And they could follow God. And so with that, he was in high demand. Even America, the people over in America got copies of it, of the book. They were so excited about what they saw, they wanted Sandeman to come over. And so in New England, he comes into that area, spends the rest of his life in New England, starting Congregationalism, and it is far more involved still in the North, but it's been less over the years. But there were groups all through the years that tried to just go back to the Bible, and it wasn't an easy task. Tottlebank was a church in northern up in the Lake District. They had been a group of people that were in London, but they were so oppressed by the established church in London, they were taxed. Their taxation was their contribution. That's how connected it was. You didn't pay your taxes to the government. You paid your taxes to the church. And if you didn't pay your taxes to the church, then you went to jail. And so they said, you know, looking at our Bible, they said, this can't be right. So they run to get away from the king, get away from the established church, and they hide out in the Lake District. I took that photograph, that building still standing. They called themselves simply a Church of Christ. I've seen some of their writings. They were not what you and I would call reestablished New Testament Christianity, but they were going in that direction. And that's what you see a lot of times when you see restoration taking place. You have to remember, denominationalism by its nature is confusing. You talk to anybody on the street and say, hey, let me tell you about the church in the New Testament. They'll say, oh, okay. And as far as they're thinking, it doesn't matter between this church on this side of the road or that church on the other side of the road. But when you open the Bible and you start telling them about what the church in the New Testament is all about, then all of a sudden, it's kind of the scales come off the eyes and they start seeing things and they go, wow, does this kind of thing go on today? Can you actually do that today? Well, that's what some of these people were trying to get to. Some of them had not gotten to that point. The Haldane brothers had a movement around 1800 going on in Scotland where they were trying to go back to the Bible. They were from this Presbyterian background who practiced what they call pedobaptism, baby baptism, because they believed part of that Calvinism, the original sin that came down. James Haldane started a movement trying to get people to just accept the Lord. Don't wait for some experience. And so while he's studying, he comes across the subject of baptism, and he comes to realize, I can't find one baby that's been baptized in the Bible. In fact, all of them were grown up, and all of them were doing it to obey the Lord. So James Haldane says, I want to be immersed. Oh, man, it just kind of blew everybody away that he was wanting to do that. But that was where the Haldanes were coming from. These young boys that grew up in Airthrie Castle, that is now in on the grounds of Stirling University. I took that photograph a few years ago. And these young men, they lost their parents when they were just kids, but there was so much money that took care of them. When James's older brother, Robert, really caught up with the idea of trying to go back to the Bible and just following the Bible and the Bible alone, he sold this castle and he sold all of his land holdings, and he used that money to pay for ministers establishing churches in different places around Scotland. One man that he utilized in this process was Greville Ewing. He was a Haldanian revivalist who influenced thousands through Saturday schools. A lot of them, people weren't educated, and so they decided, we'll have Saturday schools. They're not in the mines on Saturdays, so what are they going to do? Well, let's go. Let's give them free schooling. Well, what do we use as a text? Oh, I can't think of what to use. Oh, let's use the Bible. They used the Bible, and people learned. It wasn't until 1824 that we actually find an actual New Testament congregation after the ancient order. It's still up in the Lake District, and it was a spawn-off from the old Tuttlebank Church. But if you notice, it was 30 years before any of them heard of Alexander Campbell or Barton Stone. And when I show you this, I just want you to see and to understand that this happened a lot of times on a local level. It took a Bible and an open mind to be able to see that God has an order and a way in which he wants things to be done. And once you see that and adopt it in your mind and submit yourself to the authority of Jesus Christ, then it's possible for you to establish New Testament Christianity in your own home and in your own neighborhood. And that's exactly what takes place at Kirkby. The old church is still standing there. There's a couple preachers even buried in the cemetery back there behind. Well, I don't even know. We got to move on. I keep waiting for that bell to ring. When you come over into the United States, you have to remember the early time of this, I'm talking about before this church was established. Well, I mean back in the middle 17, late 1600s, early 1700s, when this nation was being settled. A lot of times, you know, people, when they came here, they had that pioneer spirit. They wanted to move to the West. Oftentimes they left their established churches behind. Oftentimes all they had was in their wagon that was anything slightly related to religion was their Bible, was their family Bible. And so a lot of them would go into the far-flung regions of the West, like Kentucky and Alabama nobody'd go over the Mississippi. I mean, that's just foreign country there. And so they would come into the West, and they would settle, and they would settle on the banks of creeks, and they would hew out their homes, and they'd find, I mean, if you got out there, you'd feel lonely, and you'd feel like, boy, how would we be able to worship with somebody else? How could we have a congregation? Well, there were different little movements all over the place, independent movements that started out, like at Warren County, Tennessee, Old Philadelphia. If you've been down to McMinnville, it's a little south of McMinnville, a little town of Biola. The old meeting house is still standing there, but about 1805, there's a group of people that are moving, that they live right on that creek bed, and they say, well, you know, we're all from all different kind of religious backgrounds. How can we worship together? Well, there was some people there that had been influenced by James O'Kelly, and they suggested that, why don't we do this? Why don't we do a study of the Bible together, and anything we find in the Bible of things you did in the church you were a part of, we'll adopt it, and we'll do it. But if there's something that you did in the church that you were a part of, and we can't find it in the Bible, for the sake of unity, let's leave it out. People thought, hey, that's a pretty good idea. And so as a result, you have New Testament Christianity taking place on a creek bed in southern Tennessee. Some of the great preachers of our brotherhood, Talbert Fanning, David Lipscomb, Elisha Sewell, so many more preached at the Old Philadelphia meeting house. Chester Bullard had an independent movement over in Snowville, Virginia, and he just read his Bible. He was a self-taught man. He was a self-taught doctor. But he got a hold of the Bible, he studied the Bible, and he came to realize, I need to be baptized, and I need to be baptized for the remission of sins, and the reason I need to do that is because that's what they did in the Bible. And so he obeyed the gospel, got somebody to baptize him. And so he started preaching New Testament Christianity. And all of a sudden, a few years later, he came across some writings from Alexander Campbell, and he started reading through these writings. He said, well, we're doing that already here. That's pretty good. And so he started writing letters back and forth, and you see connection taking place with Chester Bullard. Similar type thing in South Georgia with Christian Dasher. Wish I had time to talk about John Taylor over in Alabama. These men just, here again, got copy of the Bible, saw what the Bible teaches, and they followed what the Bible had to say. But these were all independent movements. All of them had never even heard of Alexander Campbell before or Barton Stone, and even though they were living around the same time and working. Well, of course, if you know very much about the history of this area, you've got to appreciate the second great revival, awakening that takes place in American history, 1797 to 1801, over in Logan County. How many of you have been to the Red River Meeting House? Have you ever been there? Folks, you're not an hour away. Go over there and visit the Red River Meeting House. It has an old Presbyterian cemetery on it. But this is where kind of a revival took place. You've got James McGrady, he's the preacher there. He's from that Presbyterian background that says you gotta have this experience. But yet that part of the world was so depressed, and I mean, they called Russellville Rogue's Harbor. I mean, that's how bad it was. People moved into that area just to get away from the law. And there was no sense of respect for human life in that area. And so there was basically a religious depression that was taking place there. And so he came across a verse It was John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Whosoever? Now wait a minute, that doesn't fit with Calvinism that says God has picked and chosen the ones he wants to save and the rest are condemned to a devil's hell. The idea that whoever wants to, whoever believes. So he starts preaching this. He starts preaching. Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved, and he that believes not shall be damned. There's a young preacher who is up north in Paris, Kentucky. He's a Presbyterian minister. His name is Barton W. Stone. He hears what's going on down here. People are getting religion. People are coming to God. And I mean, they're tearing up the countryside, basically. He comes down on horseback to find out what's going on in Logan County. And he sees what's happening there. And so when he leaves there and goes back to Cane Ridge, his first lesson is Mark 16:15-6, and he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. He that believes not shall be damned. And so he started preaching John 3:16 in a different way than he'd ever seen it before. You know, it's amazing how many times you would read a verse, come to learn something new the next time. That's what had happened with Barton Stone. So he's in northern Kentucky, he comes down. And he sees what's going on. He's so excited about what's happening in the revival. And he wants to take it back to northern Kentucky. How many of you have been to Cane Ridge? Tell me, there's got to be a lot of people. You got to go to Cane Ridge. That beautiful old, it's the largest one-room log cabin in America. It was built in the 1790s. It is absolutely beautiful. And in the 1950s, the disciples got together and they threw their money together and they built a rock structure to encase it. And it's not controlled by the disciples of Christ now. It just has a body of board of trustees that keep it up, and it's become a national shrine. People come from all over the world to visit this place, and you've got it right here in Kentucky. And so go there. Barton Stone is buried there. Thomas Campbell. So much about Thomas Campbell that we could talk about Alexander Campbell as well. Thomas Campbell was born in Ireland. He was a Presbyterian minister. He got sick. He comes over here to get well. He ends up leaving Presbyterianism. His son Alexander Campbell does the same, and they decide to devote themselves to the scriptures, to go back to the Bible and just do Bible things in Bible ways, to speak where the Bible speaks and to remain silent where the Bible is silent. You know, I wish I could really camp out on Alexander Campbell. I think he's kind of gotten a bum rap, if I can say that. And I think the reason is because we've kind of been accused through the years of being connected in a negative way to Alexander Campbell. You ever heard anybody called a Campbellite? You ever been called a Campbellite? Well, for the longest time, people just, I mean, Camp, they were talking about it. They were saying that back in his day. He hated hearing that word because all he was trying to do and trying to get people to do is to go back to the New Testament, just be Christians like you read about in the New Testament. I've read so much of his writings. That was his desire. He just wanted us to follow and do Bible things in Bible ways. And so I think he's kind of gotten a bad rap. But he's done some great things. He was a very, very intelligent man. If he'd been American born, there's some people that said he could have been the president of the United States. He could have done anything he wanted to do, but he was dedicated to the Word of God and the proclaiming of the gospel. In 1824, he comes to Kentucky. He meets Barton Stone and they get together. Stone has a Christian movement with thousands of followers. He has a reform, what was called a Reformed Baptist movement or a disciples movement that has thousands of followers. And so they decided in 1832 to join forces. They were doing the same thing. They were both trying to do Bible things in Bible ways. And so on that day, Raccoon John Smith, who was representing the disciples group, he gets up and he says, "Let us then, my brethren, be no longer Camelites," or see, they were using that word then, "Stonites, new lights, old lights, or any other kind of lights, but let us come to the Bible, and the Bible alone is the only book in the world that can give us all the light that we need." And so that was kind of the clarion call to both groups, because after this, slides ahead. After they came together, they determined that they were going to have to go and tell everybody about what was going on in both groups and see if they might be able to merge the two groups. And it was a hard effort to do, because in a lot of places they'd already kind of made enemies of one another, the disciples group, the reform group, and also the Christian group. But these men, like Raccoon John Smith, John Rogers representing the Christians, they rode together, worked together, and tried to meld the work together. A man who came down in this neck of the woods is John T. Johnson, and he's somebody you really want to get to know. He's buried up in Lexington not far from J.W. McGarvey and Raccoon John Smith, but he was probably the one who came down into what he called, or what was called, the Green River area, or the south of the Green River was where they did a lot of their work and did most of the establishing in the area. He probably would have been the one who got Alexander Campbell to come down to Smith's Grove when some people from over here in this area went over to hear Alexander Campbell, as your history says. But he had several reports. 1840, returned from 5-week trip down the south of Green River as far as Bowling Green and vicinity, and other reports in that area as well. Took this from your website, talking about 1838, a group of citizens went to hear Alexander Campbell preach at Smith's Grove. How far is Smith's Grove from here? About 30 minutes away, so not too far away. Went over there, heard what he said. And you have to remember, he was connected with the Baptist movement till about 1830. And the only reason he was ever connected with the Baptists is because he was immersed by a Baptist preacher. And once he came up out of the water, they said, well, you ought to come on, go church with us, type thing. And that's a simplistic way of saying they were together for several years. But by 1830, they were completely separated from one another. But that's where the church is established. I found some references to you in the Millennial Harbinger, 1864. You have some references to work that is being done here by S.W. Basham is the name. I was up in the cemetery a while ago, and I was looking for his grave. He may be up there in the grave. His daughter, it's a precious. I'm going to leave this with you, my slides. I'm going to leave that with Tom, and he can go through them. But his daughter passed away. A.J. Wolverton was her husband. He wrote about her death, I'm telling you, I just cried when I read it. Some sweet, sweet things that she says to her children about growing up and loving each other, reading the Bible. Read the Bible and at last come home to heaven with me. It's just some precious words, but that's in Millennial Harbinger. Well, our time is gone. Is that right? I think our time's gone, isn't it? So I was going to talk to you about James Harding. So you might have to just bring me back and we'll talk more about it. But thank you so much for letting me come and talk to you. God bless you.